Talkers.
Welcome to Speak and Destroy, episode 11. Speak and Destroy is a podcast about all things Metallica. I am your host, Ryan J. Downey, and our guest this episode is Igor Cavalera, drummer, co-founder of the legendary Sepultura and Cavalera Conspiracy. If this is your first time checking out the podcast and you enjoy this episode, please check out some of our previous episodes as well with great guests like M. Shadows from Avenged Sevenfold, Mark Morton from Lamb of God, Lizzie Hale from Hailstorm, Jamie Josta from Hatebreed, and why don't you leave us a five-star review and a sentence or two in the iTunes store. The idea here is that we have wide-ranging conversations that always come back to Metallica somehow, somewhere. Sometimes they're entirely about Metallica, sometimes they're partially about Metallica, but Metallica is the anchor, it is the continuing thread between the guests, all of whom are people who have worked with the band or toured with the band or are just big fans of the band. We hope you're enjoying what we're doing so far, because we're having a lot of fun doing it. Together with his brother Max, Igor Cavalera founded the band Sepultura in Brazil, releasing classic and important metal albums like Arise, Beneath the Remains, and Chaos AD. Though Sepultura continues today without either Cavalera brother, Max and Igor have been reunited in Cavalera Conspiracy, who just released their fourth and, in my opinion, best album. I love all the Cavalera Conspiracy records, and this one is definitely my favorite, and I'm not just saying that because it's the newest. Why would I say that? I'm not in the band. I love the record. If you don't believe me, go check it out. If you do believe me, go check it out. Either way, you should listen to that new Cavalera Conspiracy record. They also recently completed the Return to Roots tour, where they played the Roots record in its entirety. I recently had Max on as my guest on our sister podcast, No Prize from God, and I'm thrilled to present this conversation with Igor Cavalera for Speak and Destroy to all of you. Plus, I was able to ask something I've always wanted to know. Was Jason Newsted asked to join Sepultura? So here it is, my conversation with Igor Cavalera of Cavalera Conspiracy and Mix Hell. This is Speak and Destroy. Talking about this record really quick, the first thing to talk about is Max told me that you were really sick during recording and that you powered through, but that you actually recorded a lot of the drums while you were very ill.
It was crazy, man. I just trying to fight this cold, and I had this really bad cough. Like, my chest was full of really, really bad. And then I remember even the producer, Arthur, one day he came up to me and he was like, man, I was editing some of your drums and I must have about 1,000 coughs of your between tracks.
Yeah.
Like, between songs, I'll be like crazy. So it was a weird time because I was doing a lot of traveling, and I guess my my resistance went really low. But it was cool. It was cool because also, like, I don't know, when you have to do stuff, you have to do it. You know, it's the same with the show.
Yeah.
You can be sick like 5 minutes before you perform, but then when you perform, you just do it, you know. And then you go right back to being miserable again. So that was kind of like my whole thing during the recording. I was like miserable in a hotel for most of the time, and then I'll go to the studio and power all those drums and put all my energy into it, and then back to the hotel, to the point that I didn't really do anything else while I was in Phoenix. That was the only thing I did. So it was cool.
Somewhere out there, one of those like drum program people needs to get the Igor Cavalera cough. Someone can use that as like their snare sound.
I know, man. I wish they sample it, like kind of like a Sweet Leaf kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Or a joke thing in one, but I guess maybe Arthur still have some of those to play around with, like maybe a B-side of a hidden track or something like that.
You could make a Mix Hell song with that. Use it as like the rhythm track for coughing over and over.
Turn into a snare or something.
So tell me a little bit about what the process is like making these records now, because obviously with the first Cavalera Conspiracy record, you know, you guys hadn't played together in a while, and now with, you know, putting out records as CavCon and touring behind it, and then with the whole Roots tour that you guys just did, and you know, just how much more in sync, I would imagine that the two of you are. What's the process like now for putting one of these records together?
It's funny because in the first few Cavalera, we had this idea, almost like it came from like we read somewhere. We don't know how much true it is, that SOD, I think they wrote and recorded their album in like a week or something. It was something that we heard, and I thought with Max that would be cool if we could do something like this where we just put it on the spot, and then of course Max has a bunch of riffs, but to actually turn those riffs into songs we only would have a few days to do it. So the first three Cavalera records we did it pretty much like that, where we just went into the studio. I had a few of the riffs, but still all the major work was done right as we are recording. And then on this one, we change a little bit because, like you're saying, you know, like me and Max, we have such a good chemistry together that we felt it would be cool to bring someone else to do something with us. And that was Arthur, where the first three records we pretty much did ourselves with the help of a really good engineer at the time, you know, in different locations and different people. But as like a main producer, this is the first time we're working as Cavalera with someone that pretty much helped us with all the way from structuring to trying new stuff. And that's something that we haven't experienced in a long time. And that was quite, I have to say, quite surprising in a good way. Because then again, you know, like someone coming in, especially like a younger person coming in into this world that me and Max are so used to do it, it can be a little tricky, you know. Like if the person doesn't know how to act or how to deal with the whole situation, he could be tricked again into being just another engineer again.
Yeah.
And that was not the case with Arthur. Arthur came in and he was really pushing certain things. And I guess that triggered on me and Max to even go harder on certain things for this record. Yeah. Not only sound-wise, but also like just in general. Just to have something a little more fresh that maybe just me and Max wouldn't. We would be a bit more comfortable on just doing certain things, where I think Arthur, he brought in a lot more of a little like challenges for me and Max to get ourselves to like a little over a different level that we would. So that was great looking now back at it.
Yeah, that's killer. And that's what you want ultimately from a producer, you know, is somebody who you can work with and you're comfortable, but also isn't a yes man who's just going to go along with everything you want to do.
Part because that person, if he doesn't really know what he's doing, he can be like super annoying.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially dealing with two old bastards in the studio like me and Max.
Yeah.
And it's like, dude, if that person doesn't know what's up, it will be like, okay, man, we're done with you.
Yeah.
So I have to say it is something that it's cool, but at the same time, it has to be something with someone that really knows what's up.
So when you're going into, you know, when you know you have a Cavalera record coming up, what do you do to sort of mentally prepare, and what kind of, you know, given that the two of you have made so many records together before and obviously a lot of records apart with different projects and different bands, what are some of the things that you kind of go into wanting to make sure is the same in terms of like components that people recognize and expect, but also new things that you want to explore and new ways to challenge yourself or things you're inspired by, you know, that make each record different than the records you've made together?
I don't know. It's hard because at the same time, we also know that no matter how much we would try to mimic something else, it becomes something that it's ours somehow, because the way we play, the way we perform. So in that sense, I think it's cool to try stuff because we know at the end it's not going to be exactly as we we thought it would, even if we try super hard to copy something. It will be our version of that, and that already will be something completely different. So I think it's cool to have that in mind, so you don't really, you don't get trapped into the idea that I have to do something completely new. I cannot be, influenced by different stuff, which I think for some bands it's quite dangerous, because if you get into this whole paranoia of being original and being original,
yes,
and then in the end you end up not writing anything because you're not gonna like anything that comes out. So I think in that sense, that's how me and Max we try to keep a balance on where the things that we're listening to and the things that we would like to sound somehow. We try to put everything together, and at the end we know it's going to be different because we come from also a lot of different worlds and different ideas. So I think that by keeping an open mind, that helps a lot going into every project we go together.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because I was just talking about almost this exact same topic earlier in another interview, but how, like Metallica, for example, they're such an important band and so influential, and Metallica sounds like Metallica. But at the same time, if you reverse engineer it, you can say, oh, it's Diamond Head plus Motorhead with Led Zeppelin or whatever. But what makes it unique and what it is that it's those people taking those influences and combining them in a certain way that comes out through them. And yeah, I got to tell you, as somebody who's interviewed bands for, 20 plus years, how many times I hear like, oh, I don't really know how to describe us. I don't think we really fit in anywhere. We get lumped in with this genre, that genre. We don't really fit there. And it's like, there's nothing. If anything, I think that it's that much more admirable to kind of acknowledge the roots, if you'll pardon the bad pun, of where you come from. But understanding that it, exactly like you said, it's always going to be different and unique based on the fact that it's you and that it's coming through you, that's one of the things I love about Max, is that he's always paying attention to like new bands and he'll talk just as much about, Napalm Death and Terrorizer as he will like Code Orange and, Nails or something. Like, he's just always like absorbing things, but then channeling it back through like the unique voice that you guys have as artists that makes it yours. I think that's what great bands do,
Yeah. Because again, I think some people are scared of, I don't want people to find out where I got my ideas from. And it's like, come on, even if I tell you exactly all the drummers that I listen to, that I get inspired to do this record, even if you try, you're not going to be not even close to what I did, because it's a whole different way on researching and translating that into how you
translating.
So
yeah,
it's funny just because some people are so protective of certain things, and at the end of the day, I think it's just like, it's cool. If you ask, like you're saying, if you ask the dudes from Metallica, they'll probably say on the first records they were ripping off a lot of the new wave, with the British heavy metal shit, like straight up they were biting that stuff, and then of course it was their sound.
Yeah, I mean, their first few shows, they were playing Diamond Head songs and not necessarily telling the crowd they were covers. It's like, that's kind of how everyone starts, I Vili Valo from him years ago, I'm doing an interview with him where he said, yeah, my band is just Typo Negative meets U2. And it was like, he says that and you're like, yeah, I mean, it is, but it's not. It's like so much different. And you know what I mean? It's like you've made something uniquely your own out of that. But yeah, but like, I understand when you say it that way, that, and I always find that more respectable than trying to have these grand, like everyone's reinventing the wheel all the time.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's something that Max always, like from day one, he was always like, man, even his lyrics, he was like, man, like, this is based on this band or it's based on this movie, like straight up. I have no problem saying Arise, for example, it was a title that we heard from many times from this old crusty band called Amoebics from England.
Yeah.
They have an album called Arise, which me and Max will listen to it like a million times. And then when we did Arrive, we were like, man, we need to call it the same because it's such a cool name and it presents so much to us. So
yeah.
So those things were always like for us very special to, yeah, to that connection.
Max told me recently actually about this transformative experience for both of you in terms of music, going to see Queen play in Brazil as kids. And now that was like a big, you know, you guys went from being really into soccer and this and that, and whatever, it's all of a sudden it was like, music is going to be our thing. Was that the transformative moment for you as well? Were there other experiences that you had independent of Max? And what was kind of, what got you going in music?
Oh, actually, it's funny because I was already like playing the drums, like since I was like six. But I just played because I loved the drums. I didn't have any, I don't know, I didn't want to even to be in a band. I just liked the drums. So to be fair, the moment we saw Queen, it was the moment that me and Max would just look at each other. We're like, this is it. We have to turn this into, like, we got to make music, man. This is it. And it's funny because it was like an older cousin of ours who had this insight, and he was like, man, he always saw how me and Max were different from all the other kids. And I don't know, somehow he was like, dude, I think this concert is going to change their life. And it definitely did. Like, to this moment, when I see this cousin of ours, I'm like, man, you know, it's your fault. Saying it's you. And he's like, I know, I knew it. I knew that the moment you guys saw that, it will be a different thing. And it's pretty cool to see that sometimes some people can see that in kids and maybe change their whole life, you know. Yeah. And definitely for me and Max, it definitely did. Especially we're talking about Queen during the game tour in 81. So they were probably the biggest band at that time in rock. So that's one of the things. When you see a band on their top form like that, it's so inspiring. It's not like you're seeing somebody like 40 years later.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a whole different thing. Like you saw them at their peak when they were like just absolute, like destroying. Like everything in the show was perfect, from light, sound, the performance, everything. So it couldn't be more for us. Something that inspired, like, I don't know, any other show, it could be a different thing. You know, maybe if we saw, I don't know, like we saw Quiet Riot a few years later and it wasn't that amazing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, it's not Queen.
yeah. It's not Queen, you know, at that time. Maybe if we saw maybe Queen at Hot Space or something like that, it wouldn't be as killer, I think.
Yeah. So that was, and I know also it was kind of around the same time, you know, a lot of things were changing in your lives as far as, you know, losing your father, which I also lost a parent when I was young as well. And, you know, a change in lifestyle from kind of how you were accustomed to living and then, you know, that whole thing. So where did metal come into the picture for you? And do you think that those events, kind of what was happening in your life and family and everything, were those intertwined somewhere? I find a lot of people like myself, you know, I didn't realize it at the time, but as an adult, it's kind of like, oh yeah, I guess it makes sense that I got into like metal and hardcore, you know, a couple of years after my mom passes away and, yeah, you know, that kind of shit. It's sort of as an outlet, you know?
Yeah, because even at that time, I remember like me and Max, even the whole Queen thing, I remember we would look for the faster songs in it. The ballads at the time that all those bands had, we were like, yeah, that didn't do anything to us. It's like the fast songs, the songs with the more energy. So I think naturally we were looking for bands that only did that part, stripped all the other stuff and they were like focused on the energy itself. And then of course, first time you hear someone like Motorhead, you're like, yeah, that's it. There's no ballad, no crap. They just straight into it.
Just an album full of stone cold crazy. Instead of like, you have to find this one song or two. It's the whole album.
So that was something that naturally, like in metal later and hardcore, that's what we were looking for. We were looking for bands that would just keep that energy through the whole record.
Yeah. And where were you getting records at that time? Did you have stores, friends, cousins? How did you get a hold of stuff?
Well, at first, you know, of course, like all the big records, they would be made in Brazil, you know, like the stuff like Kiss, Queen, and then of Sabbath, Zeppelin, all that stuff, it was there. And then later on, once we started discovering the more like underground stuff, and then we needed to dig a little more to find our stuff, like start tape trading, exchanging vinyl with different people.
Yeah.
Like we're buying like certain fanzines and then doing the thing that a lot of the kids in the 80s did, which was like looking through the tank list of
yes. yep. I talk about this all the time. Yeah. And
be like, okay, out of like this 30 names, I know there's something that's going to really kick ass, because if they're mentioning them, they have to be good.
Yeah.
All those things add up, especially in Brazil. It was so hard to find those records. So we had to, like, a friend would travel. It would be like, okay, you need to bring, you know, this, I don't know, this five records. So it was all kinds of ways of trying to get music through, you know.
Yeah, the thanks list was big for me. All, yeah, like the late 80s, early 90s. Also, and I end up talking about this on this podcast a lot too, but the t-shirts that bands would wear, you know, yeah. That would always, that turned me on to so many bands. I mean, whether it's, you know, the Misfits, the Cro-Mags, you know, seeing guys in bigger metal bands that were repping some of these smaller bands. That's how I would discover so many of them. I've said this before, people listening to this podcast are probably already tired of hearing it, but I discovered the Dead Kennedys because David Ellefson had a Dead Kennedy sticker on his bass. And I had a Megadeth poster on my wall with that, you know, and it's like, then I see that at the record store and I'm like, because also you know, you only have so much money when you're a kid, and you didn't, you weren't hearing these bands on the radio. There was no way to check it out if you didn't have a friend turning you on to it. You really had to kind of just roll the dice and spend all of your money on a record and hope that you really liked it.
I remember buying also records because of the cover and being disappointed at some of them.
Yes, yes.
That I'll go to a record store and it's like, man, if this have like a crazy devil and it gotta be good, and then listen to it and it's like, wow, they only had the cover, the rest, you know.
I
think it was a band called Demon at the time, and we bought one of their records and it didn't do it for us. We were like, man, this is not what we were expecting from the cover.
Well, and I used to see records from like Molly Hatchet and, you know, bands that had like those Frank Frazetta like Barbarian covers, and I would think like, oh, this is going to be like metal. And then get it. And I'm like, what is this? This is not what I like.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And and then meanwhile, on the flip side, you know, I discovered Celtic Frost because of the cover art, like straight up 100%. It was the Emperor's Return EP. And I was just like, this has got to be good. Like just based on how it looked. And then it was, you know, it worked.
But I have to say, most of the time it would work, because a lot of the bands, you know, like they were really pushing the limits of art and trying really cool stuff.
Yeah.
Then and again, like, you would get completely disappointed, especially because you didn't have that much money to buy a bunch of records.
Yeah, it was going to be a while before you could take that chance again.
Pick that one, and it was wrong. It was that word.
Yeah. So what was your introduction to Metallica specifically? Do you remember what the first Metallica song you heard was, and how and where and all that sort of thing?
I remember me and Max, we got into Metallica. Someone recorded like a tape of Kill 'Em All, and it was really cool because at that time we were also listening to a lot of punk and all together. And I think the fact that in Brazil we're so naive to experiment the music, we had no separation between a lot of the stuff that we were getting, like. A tape would have on the A side Kill 'Em All, and then on the B side it would have like Discharge or Vengeance. And for us that was like, it's fucking killer. This whole tape is killer. You know, there's two bands, they're sick. And then later we would find out that it's like, wow, that one, it was like a metal band, and the other one was like a...
I had a very similar experience with, you know, when friends would make you tapes, and you know, compilations were a big thing. Like my whole introduction to hardcore was somebody taped the New York City Hardcore the Way It Is compilation on Revelation. And it's like, you know, Gorilla Biscuits. I think Youth of Today was on there. Sick of It All. You know, all those bands I was hearing the first time. And like at the compilation setting. And then you would go out and like, you know, buy the full links from the bands you liked on there. So, yeah, I know what you mean as far as like, a lot of times those bands would kind of bleed together and you didn't really understand the distinction between like, oh, this is a punk band, this is a crossover band, this is thrash, this is power metal, this is like, it just all seemed like, I don't know, heavy music to me at a certain point.
Yeah, and I, you know, Metallica, for us, it was one of those bands where they were in the middle of all these things that we were discovering.
Yeah.
So it was not like we found one band and we were like, oh, this is it. They're amazing. We're only going to listen to this now. We never had that moment, you know, like I think with Metallica, there was like at least five or six bands that we were like, yeah, this is all fucking cool.
Yeah.
So we never had like the Metallica fever, I would say, even though we thought like they were great, you know, like especially the first few records, they were like always surprising us with cool stuff.
Yeah, I felt like they pushed the boundaries each time. You know, it's like, I was too young to be into them back then. But apparently, like even when Ride the Lightning came out, there were fans that were like, oh, there's a ballad on here. You know, the record's not fast enough or whatever. You know, it's like every time they put out a record, there was some kind of pushback about how they were pushing the envelope every time. And I think, you know, obviously history has proven that those were actually smart creative decisions that they were making and pushing forward, you know.
Definitely.
You know how it goes. Every time you put out a record, everyone complains that it doesn't sound like the last one. And then when the next one comes out, the one that they didn't like before is now the classic that you're measured against.
Yeah. And it's all good, man. You know, I mean, like the funny thing with Metallica, especially as a drummer, is that I always felt that Lars had a much better style when he was not too worried about being a good drummer. Like once he became too anal about like everything, every little hit, like with the Black Album and everything. And then that's when I think most people realized that he was not that much of a solid drummer. Where I think in Kill 'Em All and Ride the Light, even on Master of Puppets, the weird style that he had, it was amazing. It was really cool. And then later, like the more that he stripped down and make it more minimalistic, it gave him like a really bad rap as a drummer.
I think there's something really unique about his chemistry that he has with Hetfield, where there's something about Hetfield's, you know, right hand and his rhythm playing that's very percussive almost. It's almost like the rhythm guitars are the drums and a lot of that old Metallica stuff, that the unique way that Lars played fit with that. And especially before, you know, things being put into a grid and everything being so like, you know, precise with like the little tempo shifts and things like that. There was like a magic in that, you know, the mistakes even.
Yeah. But I have to say, I could only imagine if James played the drums and the guitars, I think that it would be lethal.
and he is a drummer, right?
I see him get on the drums and it's like, wow, it's a good thing he doesn't do much because Lars will be out of a job like in a second.
I will say, you know, I was talking about this. I was with Dave Peters from Throwdown 2 days ago, and we were talking about there's this part in Now That We're Dead, one of the songs on the newest Metallica album, where he does this double bass thing and this thing on the toms that like I couldn't imagine another drummer putting in that spot in the riff. Like it kind of doesn't make sense. But then I was saying like it's almost that much more cool and incredible because a quote unquote better metal drummer, you know, wouldn't think to do that. And it's just something that he came up with because his sensibility is so different. And then it turns out being something cool, you know? So I think there are examples of that, you know, in his playing. It's also interesting to me. I don't know if you ever saw videos or anything, but There was some festival where Lars couldn't make the show, and they had like Joey Jordison and Dave Lombardo filled in. And there's a bunch of it on YouTube. And, you know, those guys are obviously both, you know, two of the best drummers ever. And Joey in particular, you would think going into it that it would be Lombardo, but it was really Joey who really was just killer. But at the same time, it's like, you know, it's awesome. And it was clear that he was a fan and he knew every little fill and everything. And he was also doing it in his own style and just so solid and whatever. But it is different. You know, it's like they're a band where it's like, for better or worse, you know, the drummer.
Yeah, and again, they are also playing his parts.
Yes, true.
You know, and I think that's something that a lot of people don't acknowledge on drummers.
Yeah,
that it's for me. I appreciate a lot more someone that creates certain parts, almost like as riffs.
Yeah,
than someone that is the technical perfect.
Yes,
you know, for me, is I like drummers who come up with stuff instead of just, you know, following the guitar or doing whatever. So in that sense, I think, you know, like he has his credits, you know, on creating certain riffs with his drum patterns.
Mm-hmm.
Same with Lombardo. I think, you know, for me, that's where I appreciate. It's like, look, you're not just following, you're making your own thing and you're writing your own music on the drums. And then that's something that some people, they forget. They just look for the perfect drummer with the perfect technique. And for me, that's boring, you know?
God, I'm so in agreement with you. I'd be curious what you think about this, because for me, with Slayer in particular, and this isn't, you know, this is nothing personal about anybody, but just as a fan, as a listener, I think Slayer has had better, quote unquote, drummers than Lombardo from a technical standpoint and consistency and whatever. But Lombardo's the best drummer in Slayer. Like, no question. You know what I mean? It's like that's... And it's a hard thing to explain, because you'll talk to some people who are very technically minded and, like you said, are always looking for the perfect technique. And it's just like, yeah, man, but only Dave Lombardo was going to write those drum parts and spill the blood. And yeah. You know what I mean? Like, that's just...
Yeah.
And you're one of those drummers, too, where there's... In metal, there's few drummers, especially now with the way records are made and how... You know, somebody's just sampling like Gene Hoglan's snare from some kit or whatever. You know what I mean? It's like everything's reamped and whatever. There are a few drummers in metal, and I would 100% put you on this list, where you recognize they're playing. You know what I mean? Like, you can hear that drummer under any riff and go like, yeah, oh, that's so-and-so. You know, that's Igor. That's Dave Lombardo. Yeah.
That's where I come in with the whole Lars thing. And I think he has a lot of credits on a lot of drum parts that he wrote, where, you know, like we're saying, he you know, he set up something that it's him, you know.
Yeah.
And that's a lot more important than the dude that does like a crazy drum solo for 20 minutes and and it's not my thing, you know. At the end of the day, like, I do like drummers who can, of course, who have like some technical part on it, but I think it's way more about being in the pocket and just, yeah, like, you know, that's what I like to see when I drum. I like to feel the drums, not someone that is depending on effects and things, but he can actually hit the drums so they sound amazing on stage, and of course they're gonna sound good on the PA.
Yes. You know, there's another great example of what we're talking about is Bill Ward, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, Bill Ward's not the most technically skilled drummer. He's fucking Bill Ward, and it sounds like Black Sabbath in large part because of how Bill Ward plays the drums.
Yeah, well, he's definitely my hero, you know, in that sense. And I think, of course, a lot of people, you know, everyone focus on Bohan and the whole Zeppelin thing, but for me, he's as important as John Bohan, you know, in the fact that he creates so much crazy cool stuff with Sabbath there. It's like he's drum riffs for me, they're like, again, as important as Tony Iommi's riffs.
Yes, 100%. And I'm and by the way, for a quick side note, I'm doing a Q&A, moderating a Q&A with Tony Iommi in a couple weeks at the Musicians Institute here in LA, and I'm so fucking psyched. I've never met him or interviewed him or anything, and it's just one of those, like,
yeah, we met
them.
Those
are the hands, you know, that made metal, you know?
Yeah. And he's such a cool guy, too, man. It's, you know, that's the cool thing about it. You know, like someone, him or even Bill Ward, we met them and they were so cool, you know, like just chill, because they know, you know, they don't need to prove anything. They know what.
I say that all the time because I also, you know, in addition to music journalism, I've covered a lot of movies, right? And people will ask me about different actors and actresses and say like, oh, is, you know, so-and-so an asshole or is this or that or whatever. And dude, I've always said that the one, if there's any truism, any consistency, it's that the higher up the food chain somebody is in the movie world, the cooler they are. And it's because if I walk into a room to interview, you know, Johnny Depp or Tom Cruise or somebody, they don't have shit to prove to me. You know, they're comfortable in their own skin. They're cool. And those are the people that are the nicest to you because, I don't know, they're interested in the person on the other side of the table. It's more sort of this B and C list are the people that you see showing up with the entourage and making sure you know they're somebody because they're trying to prove they're somebody. I've always wanted to ask you this. I don't remember what year it was. It might have been like 1998 or something. And it's great because it's been so long now that I think it won't be touchy. But there was, I think it was Metal Hammer or something like that. One of those magazines had Jason Newsted on the cover. And there was a big poll quote about him wanting to sing for Sepultura. And this was after the split with Max and everything, obviously. And this is just me being a Metallica nerd. I remember the rumor anyway was that caused some a little bit of trouble in the Metallica camp. When that article came out. But I'm always curious, you know, now obviously hindsight and, you know, everything, so much has happened and God, I guess it's been 20 years. What was the situation back then at the time? Was that an idea that was ever discussed? Were you guys, because I know he was a big supporter of Sepultura and you guys were friends with him, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was never mentioned, I have to say. Because he was such a good friend of ours that it was, you know, to be fair, it was really in respect of what he did in Metallica. We would never ask something like this. It's as like asking, you know, like in football, the coach for whatever, you don't want to ask that coach to leave and come to your team unless that coach, it's out of a job.
Right.
That's how I see it. So it was never a question. Even maybe he thought, I don't know, you know, it was his desire. But for us at the time, no, we never thought about that, you know, especially because maybe if he wasn't playing with Metallica, it would be a completely different thing.
Yeah.
But we never asked him or even mentioned things like that.
Were there other guys from bands of that era that you looked at or talked to or that tried out for the gig at that time?
Not really. I think everyone was pretty much chilled, you know, in the sense that nobody came forward or asked or anything like that. It was really, and then again, I think it was also, we wanted something new.
Yeah.
So I think it was a combination of both, of us not redoing something and also not having someone from another band. And
yeah, that's always my advice to bands, even, you know, when there's a significant lineup change, especially a singer. I feel like going with somebody who's quote-unquote unknown or lesser known is always the better move, because as soon as you get somebody who's so established somewhere else, then it becomes like, oh, this person plus this band. You know, like Avenged Sevenfold with Mike Portnoy instead of just Avenged Sevenfold, you know? You know, obviously sometimes it works out really cool, like Black Sabbath with Dio, and, you know, there are some exceptions, but I think generally it's kind of a bad move to get someone of equal or greater stature in the scene, because it starts to overshadow what the band is on its own.
Yeah, and I think, you know, like, been like Sabbath also, of course, they were friends, you know.
Yeah,
it's like when Ian Gillan did Born Again, you know, they were chilling together. It's like, yeah, you want to do this, you know, it's different.
Yeah.
So I don't know, for us it was a complete different thing.
How did that relationship begin with Sepultura and Jason Newsted? Do you remember what, because I remember as a fan just him wearing, you know, Sepultura shirts and hoodies and stuff and pictures and always kind of repping and being a supporter. Where did you guys first connect?
Well, actually, it's crazy because the first time we played at the Omni in Oakland, mm-hmm. James was there. He came to see us. And of course, we were all freaking out because he was backstage and hanging out. And it was him and Jim Martin from Faith No More at the time.
Wow, yeah.
And I remember me and Max were like, dude, this is crazy. You know, there's people that we listen to, it, they're actually here. And Paul Ballard from Exodus.
Oh, wow. Rest so in peace. Like,
yeah, yeah. And actually, Paul, he was so crazy. He the next day we were playing L.A., and he jumped on the van with us, and he came to L.A. So he was like a wild dude.
Yeah, yeah. Like you would want him to be.
yeah, exactly. So at first we met James, and then later on we met Jason, and he was like – totally into like what we were doing. Like he knew every song, and then to the point that I visit him once at his house, and I found out that he had two cats, and his cats were called Max and Eagle.
That's fucking awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
That's so fucking cool.
Yeah, but and to be fair, he's one of the coolest bass players ever.
Absolutely.
Like crazy. I remember like watching him, and he's insane, you know, like he's so good. And of course, jamming with him, like we had the chance to play with him a few times. Like I remember even like jamming like the Misfits or some stuff. And the bass is just like, it's beyond, like it's different when someone can play the bass with that much aggression.
Yes.
He's one of the guys, you know. And I remember finishing playing with him and being like, are you sure you're playing the same bass as our bass player was playing?
Yeah, I mean, because it's like he, just that attack. I mean, when I think about his style of playing, I think about hard work, like somebody who's working hard every second, you know, like just like he's like a weightlifter or something, you know what I mean? Like just.
Oh, man. And it was funny because he also made a comment that made me like completely like uncomfortable. We finished playing like the Misfits thing, and I said the whole thing about the bass, and he looked at me and he was like, well, on the other hand, I don't remember the drums on this song sounding so amazing. So we're both kind of like complimenting each other, and I was like, wow, man, this is fucking cool.
Yeah,
because he played that song a million times, you know, with Metallica.
Yeah,
which was, I think it was Green Hell that we did, you know, like just jamming in our room.
Yeah. Oh, it's so fucking cool. Did you guys ever record stuff with him at his studio, the Chop House or what? You know, he always.
Yeah, we did. We did one song there for one of the later Sepultura stuff. And then.
Oh, that's right. I knew
a lot of demos and stuff. Like you should call me to come to the house to do demos, but I was always like, and then Andreas at the time he did a few visits to his studio to do some crazy like bands under different names that they did together, so that was kind of cool.
Yeah, he's got, I mean, Newstead has just a vault full of all kinds of weird projects, and you know, Machine Head and Voivod and all these different people coming by, and Sepultura obviously. Yeah, it's so cool. I always, you know, like we were talking about, kind of bringing our conversation full circle, you know, those bands that would rep for other bands and how, and that process of discovery. And, you know, I always thought Newstead was kind of that ambassador. Even when he first joined the band, he would wear like Sacred Reich t-shirts and Flotsam and Jetsam t-shirts, and kind of would really push to raise the visibility of a lot of the bands that were coming up. And I see you guys doing that. I mean,
especially in metal, because I think that's the thing with Metallica. Those guys were wearing a lot more of like obscure like punk bands and hardcore,
mm-hmm.
and even like, you know, like stuff like Sister of Mercy or The Mission.
Yeah.
And then Jason came in and he was like, no, this is happening right now in metal, where I didn't see the guys from Metallica represent that much.
Yeah.
You know, like they wouldn't wear like a band, like a metal band from right now, where Jason was like, no, this is fucking cool, man. These guys are killing right now.
Yeah.
So I think in that sense, he was more of like the new guy, kind of like bringing in some of like the heat that was happening at the time.
Yeah. And I remember, you know, honestly, as somebody who was a metal kid and then became a hardcore kid and whatever, I always remember Igor from Sepultura being the guy that would wear Hatebreed and Earth Crisis and Integrity and all these bands that I was, you know, friends with or going to see or playing shows with or whatever at the time. And that was in a similar way to Newstead repping Sepultura. I remember for a lot of us kids in the hardcore scene, especially in the Midwest, you know, even getting somebody like Derek, who was a known hardcore guy in Cleveland, you know, like, I don't know, it was always, it was a very similar sort of thing. Like Igor was the guy in Sepultura who was like Newstead, the guy in Metallica who was repping for Integrity and Hatebreed and stuff like that. I always thought that was really, really cool. What's making you psyched these days? What are you inspired by music-wise?
There's a lot of cool stuff, man, I have to say. You know, like, that's the cool thing about me and Max. We still act like we're 15.
Yeah.
Every time we see each other, I have to drop, like, at least, like, 15 names on his, like, Spotify thing.
Yeah.
And then he's the same. He's like, dude, check out this black metal thing, you know, like from, and he always find like the craziest, most obscure shit. So it's really cool. We exchange a lot of ideas. I think one of the last bands he showed me, it was a Zeal and Ardor.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And those guys from Switzerland.
Yeah.
And that was pretty cool.
That's a name I've been seeing. I haven't actually listened to it yet. So I got to check that
super out. Cool. Super cool. It's almost like, it has this like a slave kind of like vibe to it.
I love how Enslaved has gotten like all weird and psychedelic in these last like several albums, and but still like,
yeah,
you know, dark.
Yeah, no, I know it's and then I don't know, like now, of course, like the latest Full of Hell, the record, it's insane. Yeah.
And you guys took them on tour with the Roots thing, right? They toured it through.
Yeah. I also did a remix for one of their songs for like their Japanese version of their record, mm-hmm. which came out with a few remixes, like something more electronic. So, and of course, The Body, it's one of those bands that it's my favorite right now. Like, they're insane. They're so good. Like a duo, also again, like two crazy guys making a lot of weird noise. And yeah. There's cool stuff. I don't know. Yeah, this band called Vatican Shadow.
I haven't heard that.
Yeah, it's not really a band. It's more like a project. And it's really cool stuff. More electronic, noisy, kind of like almost like industrial.
I have to check that out. Vatican Shadow. I know your brother was telling me he was baptized at the Vatican.
Yeah.
Speaking of the Vatican, it's crazy, man.
That's the most evil place on earth to be baptized.
The Vatican.
A lot more evil than anybody else.
A lot of evil is associated with that. It's funny, you know. I had this conversation with Dwid not that long ago about. He was saying, he's like, you know, all these black metal guys that are so evil. He's like, they should really all become Catholics because the Catholic Church has done the most evil.
That's it.
Yeah,
he nailed it as always. Dwid is also a really good friend.
Yeah, he's one of my oldest friends. Actually, we've known each other since 19. You know, what's funny actually is I just dug this out semi recently. It's sitting right here on my desk. This is the I don't know if you can see that. There it is. The Integrity demo that Dwid sent me in 1989, and it still has. This was actually how we met, and I have so few things. I have so little things from my childhood pictures or whatever, but I have this letter that Dwid wrote to me in 1989 with this phone number. That's how we met, and we've been friends ever since.
That's cool. I love him. He's such a cool guy.
He's the best. Yeah, I saw he came out and I think sang a Motorhead song or something with you guys when you were in Europe class.
Because it's funny because I do a lot of electronic stuff in Ghent in Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day I was walking around and I saw this guy that looked just like him. And we kind of like look at each other and we're like, nah. And then I came back to my hotel and then I get a message like, dude, are you in Belgium? And I was like, holy shit, it was you. And then we were just in the same place, but we couldn't believe we saw each other. And the next day we went for a coffee and then every time I'm in Ghent in Belgium where he lives, we hang out.
That's so cool. And especially to see each other in Belgium, because it's like, no, he lives in Brazil. No, he's from Cleveland.
Yeah, exactly.
it's like
totally off. Yeah.
So I got to ask you the last question. You know, obviously Max has Cavalera Conspiracy, Soulfly, Killer Be Killed, these different things he's doing. And I know that, you know, you do a lot of the electronic stuff, the noise stuff. Obviously people are familiar with Mix Hell. Do you have any inclinations towards doing something else metal in addition to Cavalera? Is there, you know, like a band with Dwid, for example, you know, or something like that?
I talked to him about maybe doing something in the future, because he's one of my favorite like singers.
Yeah.
So maybe that would come. Like there's also some ideas of doing something a little more hardcore, not so much metal.
Mm-hmm.
Some friends here in London. I have this really good friend. He sings in a Turbo Negro.
Yeah, sure.
And he used to be in a lot of like hardcore bands, and we've been talking maybe about doing a project together. Like,
oh, that's cool.
Just fun. Yeah. So there is stuff, but then again, it's hard, you know, like with everyone doing so much stuff all the time, to actually sit down and write a record, it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
So I don't know when that would be possible, you know.
Yeah, like you were saying with the Cavalera record, you gotta carve out the time and focus and do it, and then it's like, okay, I'm sick, but this is it's now or never. Yeah. We gotta make this record right now.
Yeah.
It's not gonna happen.
Yeah, it has to, you know. So hopefully I have a little more time to do some different projects, which I always love to. And then Max, of course, he's like the James Brown of metal.
Yep.
Like the hardest working guy in the metal. He doesn't stop.
Yeah, Greg always says, he's like, Max pisses riffs.
Yeah, he does. And another funny story in the record is that at one point, Arthur, which is the producer,
uh-huh,
he ended up with like, I don't know, like 20 CDs full of Max's riffs. And at one point we had to stop and we're like, look, man, we have material here for like 5 records. We need to stop on this. And he was like, yeah, sure. But it's like you're saying, like he just shits riffs every day, man. They're good ones. So that,
yeah, that's the thing too. Good ones. That's what's so insane about it, you know.
Killer.
Yeah, and it's like the records only happen, even it seems like, when somebody like you or Arthur or Greg or, you know, somebody comes in and is like, all right, let me take all these riffs and do some shit here. And like, you know, we got to make a record, man. So slow down with the riffs. Yeah, I love it. Well, Igor, thank you so much for taking the time to do this, man.
I'm glad it worked out.
Well, thanks, man. We'll stay safe
out
there. And yeah, hope to talk to you soon.
Hope to see you soon, man.
Yeah, man. Cheers. Take care. If you would like to support this podcast, all I'm going to ask you to do right now is go to the iTunes store, either go through the podcast app on your iPhone, go on your desktop, go on your Dell computer, maybe you have one of those computers with a little alien head on it, whatever you got, go to iTunes, 5 stars, just a sentence is all you really got to leave. The more of those 5-star reviews that we get with a sentence or two written to accompany it, the higher the visibility for the podcast, the more people can discover it. And when we reach 100 reviews, I'm going to pick one of you fine people who has reviewed this podcast at random and send you the deluxe collector's edition box set of Kill 'Em All, the debut album from this band called Metallica, courtesy of our friends at Warner Music. You can find Speak and Destroy on all of the various social media platforms. You can find me at Ryan Downey on Twitter, at Superhero HQ on Instagram. Speak and Destroy is part of the Pop Curse Podcast Network. As always, you guys have been great. And I've been Ryan J. Downey.